Hello, I'm Arvin Hickman and welcome to the PR Weekly. John Harrington, PR Week's UK editor, is back.
Hello.
How are you going, John?
I'm good, thank you, Arvind. I'm recording this on Wednesday and I'm very nervous because of a certain sporting occasion happening this evening. Although by the time everyone listens to this, you'll know the result.
Well, we will know if football is going to come home or not, won't we?
We certainly will.
And how optimistic are you?
Well, the problem is everyone's going to... By the time people listen to this, they'll know whether I'm right or wrong. I mean, I do think England will just about sneak past, but I think it will be a very difficult game against the Danes. So when you listen to this and we've won 6-0, you can you're within your rights to mock me as much as you can, but I don't think it will be 6-0. I think it will be a very nervy game, and I think England will just about win it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it'll be very close, but I think football is going to come home, at least for another round, which will be the final against Italy. Anyway, in this episode, John, we're going to discuss Cannes Lions, the Purpose Awards, the government's new COVID public health messaging, PR recruitment and salaries, and maybe a bit of Euros at the end. Today, we are joined by Lanson CEO Tony Langham and Red Havas Managing Director Rachel Sansom. How are we all?
Very good, thank you, Arvin. Delighted to be here.
I'm delighted, and I'm preparing to go to Wembley, actually. But I'm delighted.
Are you, serious? Your ticket? That's incredible.
Yeah.
So you obviously think football is definitely coming home.
Well, I go with Peter Schmeichel's answer, Wiz. I don't think you've ever won it before, so how can it?
Can't argue with logic. Anyway, let's kick off with Cannes Lions. Now, Rachel, you're a judge for the PR Lions. What were some of the trends and some of the PR campaigns that really caught your eye?
Well, I think in terms of, I think what it was very interesting in that COVID definitely didn't dominate the entries, which was obviously quite surprising. But everything was a lot. I think there was a general greater tone of empathy, which was to be welcomed. I mean, in terms of key trends, it happens every year. Technology marched on. I thought there were a lot of campaigns in the PR category that used deep fakes.
Deep fake
technology, yeah. And, you know, sometimes that was used as a force for good. Sometimes it was a bit of a stunt. I think there is a challenge for us as a PR industry in terms of how we utilise that technology moving forward, given that we have to deal with fake news, fake influencers, etc. But that was an interesting innovation, and I'll be interested to see, you know, how that technology is used as we move forward.
That is really interesting because, no, I didn't realise that deepfake technology was being used so much at Cannes. I mean, is this something that's relatively new?
Yeah, I mean, I believe so. I mean, I think we sort of saw deepfake technology kind of, you know, hit the news agenda kind of towards the end of last year in a mainstream way. And we had to judge 20 and 21 entries, and it was only the 21 entries that we saw it starting to be used.
Can you give us an example of how it's being used?
Yeah, so there was a campaign that was done in Mexico, and it was around kind of cessation of violence around the cartels and drugs, etc. And they actually brought back to life an activist that had been killed by one of the drug cartels using deepfake technology to head the campaign. As I describe it there, that might sound a bit vulgar. It was obviously done with the backing of his family, etc. But I mean, actually, that was one of the examples where it, you know, it was used at least purposefully. There were some other examples, and I'm not going to name names, where it was sort of used as a bit of a stunt mechanism. And I'm not sure that's really an appropriate use of the technology moving forward. There was also actually another campaign from the US where around gun violence cessation, where, a teenager had been killed, was brought back via deepfake technology to campaign for gun violence cessation. So again, you know, there's a huge amount of moral questions attached to it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see how it pans out as we move forward, basically.
Tony, what's your view on that, using deepfake technology for PR campaigns?
Yeah, well, I sort of applauded it in the Mexican journalist case because it clearly was with the go-ahead of his family, and it clearly had a major impact, and it was a winner. I'm sure, Rachel, I saw it in the winners. Mm. So I think it was that's a fantastic example. I think we're going to go into this horribly worrying world of deepfake videos being all over our society, and I think they're going to start future political scandals that the term deepfake is going to be used as a defense mechanism by people in real situations, and it's going to be used most worryingly, I think, at the last minute in election campaigns. So I think I can only be deeply worried, and I sort of, my head goes off into the area of, you know, the area of society where we're going to turn to the tech giants and say, you should do more to flag things and control things. And I suspect this is going to be, maybe this is going to be 2022 or 2023's big government to big tech conversation.
Absolutely. John, what was your take on the Cannes Lions? I mean, Danny Rogers, our editor-in-chief, wrote an amazing piece about how PR agencies are starting to win more different categories rather than the PR Lions. How did you view, you know, the Lions in general, and how some of the PR agencies performed?
Yeah, well, it's always, every year is the, you know, like clockwork, there's the debate about how PR agencies have performed, and particularly the fact that they don't seem to win that many of the Lions in the PR Lions category. I do think, as Danny sort of made the point, it's sort of, we need to look beyond that in a way. I mean, I do think it's about more than just that category, although it's a shame that PR agencies don't win more. But you've got to look at things like the sheer number of entries that ad agencies submit. Although it's a shame, I don't think it's as terrible as some people make out. But there are some real breakthroughs. Edelman in particular won some significant awards in other categories. And as Danny makes the point, it does show that PR can kind of move into so many different areas. Ultimately, is such an important thing because, you know, this is an industry that generally has fared better than others, dare I say, better than the advertising industry over the period of the pandemic. And I think part of its strength is the ability to adapt and to move into these other areas like, you know, a purpose, ESG. That's my sort of overall take on it. Going back to the deep fake thing, it's interesting that every year there seems to be a kind of theme that was probably very novel sort of 6 months, 9 months before the actual awards happened, when everyone was thinking, oh, this is going to blow people away because they think it's all really new. I remember probably 5 years ago, it might be the first time I went, there was the chair of the Lions then, of the PR Lions, spoke about emoji fatigue, how every award seems to be, oh, and we've proposed these new emojis and we've got these new emojis for saving the whale or selling cornflakes or whatever. And they were really quite cynical about it. And I wonder if, you know, deepfake is going to be next year's emoji, in the sense that it seems sort of creative and novel now. And we're all very interested in it. But things can either sort of become very mainstream or become very cliched. But overall, for the PR world, I don't think they should be disheartened. I think quite the opposite. You know, obviously, it's always better to win more. And I think there was kind of a lack of independent, particularly independent UK agencies, even getting shortlisted this year, which was noticeable. But I don't know if that's just to do with the fact that there were cutbacks during COVID and people were entering other awards. So I imagine there probably was an element of that.
John, just to build on that point, actually, I think obviously I was only in the PR category, but there were no entries, as far as I could see, from independents. I didn't see all of the entries, but I did see a fair amount of them, you know, during the shortlisting process. And I think in terms of PR agencies being more successful, my main takeout now, having sort of been on the inside, is like more confidence. You know, the work that we do, particularly in this market, will totally match some of the work that was coming in from elsewhere. And I sort of wonder if we lack a bit of confidence in really putting our foot forward. And I think, to your point, resources is also an issue because you do have to have a really good case film, etc.
I think from the PR leaders that I speak to, it's about prioritising which awards you enter. And Cannes Lions isn't necessarily at the top of that list. But I totally agree. I think some of the work over here, you know, easily would have won many more awards if it had been entered. I just think, how many awards can you enter? And I think some of the independent agencies particularly are very much focused on the industry awards and the ones that matter more for them in their day-to-day life.
Absolutely.
Speaking of awards, John, our Purpose Awards came out last week. Were there any campaigns that really caught your eye?
Yes, it's interesting you talk about agencies, you know, UK agencies particularly sort of focusing elsewhere, and it really feels like Purpose Awards has been one of those. And obviously purpose is one of those themes that goes beyond emojis and deep fake, and it is here to stay, I'm
definitely
sure.
Definitely beyond emojis.
I don't think any emoji campaigns won. But I mean, there were a few. I mean, I think it's worth shouting out one campaign that won a hat trick of awards, which is Climate Store by Prime Weber Shandwick for Felix, which is a sort of supermarket group in Sweden. It involved a pop-up grocery store in which kind of the price, inverted commas, of food would be sort of linked to its carbon footprint. So basically, it's a really good way of showing customers the carbon usage. Incidentally, it also won Campaign of the Year at the PR Week Global Awards. And it was shortlisted at Cannes, I believe.
It's a brilliant idea, and I really hope it takes off. Like it should actually be happening, shouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are a few others as well. I mean, there was a brace of awards for this one called Fabric of the Community by W Communications for Grenfell Athletic FC. Which was effectively kind of shirt sales from celebrities to raise money for the community football club created in the aftermath of the Grenfell fire. So that was really good as well. I mean, I think generally some of the trends I was noticing with the Purpose Awards, both at the awards, but also Cannes and other award schemes, is it does seem to me that Purpose Awards are kind of developing and maturing recently. It feels like maybe the kind of creative element of it and the originality took a bit of a backseat during the sort of the depths of the COVID crisis last year. But when I think brands and companies were sort of focusing more on kind of comforting messages and how they can help rather than what sort of creative out there ideas they can put in place. But I think that's sort of swung back a bit more recently. And obviously as...
Which is good to hear.
It is, yeah. And I think, you know, and obviously it's easy to do that once kind of the economies open up and things like shops open up. I mean, if you were having strict social distancing, a pop-up grocery store probably wouldn't work. I mean, obviously this is in Sweden where, as we know, they didn't do that to the extent that other countries did anyway. But yeah, it kind of looks... It feels to me as though a lot of purpose campaigns are getting more focused and there's sort of more... emphasis on long-term commitments, really, rather than necessarily kind of jumping on, you know, any kind of good cause.
I'd like to get Tony and Rachel's view on this.
On purpose generally, I think it's really interesting. I think we all talk, I think most of us talk this year, ESG purpose. It's the year of ESG purpose. We try and talk to organisations about their core purpose. Everything clearly works better if organisations are living right through the pores of their skin, as an organization like IKEA does, for instance. I think we're all intimately involved in that. We're all, I would say, particularly speaking personally, I find myself pointing out where organizations aren't walking the walk as well as talking the talk. So I find myself holding back organizations sometime and suggesting different routes. I think it's maybe it's a function of being older in the industry. I'm really conscious of charges of purpose washing and greenwashing and diversity washing, etc. I think it's really important. I think it's I hear what you say about things as fundamental, and obviously that's what I believe in. But you mentioned Grenfell. It is really, really important if organizations can connect with community and connect with society. And often the things that people instantly respond to are the things that are happening now, or things that have just happened, or things that are sweeping TikTok or Twitter or whatever it is. So I think there is also a case for organizations. If you know what you stand for, I think you can act quickly. And I think there is a case for responding to immediate events if it activates particularly younger people towards brands and to do good.
Mm. Rachel, I mean, a lot of people will call out companies that are hypocritical when they have these purpose campaigns. What is your view on it?
Well, I mean, I think as Tony just said, I think the days of purpose washing are well and truly over. I think, you know, everybody can spot it a mile off. You know, whatever your stakeholder audience is, you cannot get away with doing purpose for purpose's sake anymore. It's got to be baked into the heart of the organization. And I think one of the things that I've sort of found really encouraging in my client conversations over the last year is how seriously people are taking their purpose-driven initiatives, how it is being championed from the top all the way down. People want to be real about it. They want to be authentic. They want it to mean something. You know, they want it to make a difference. So, and you know, I think this is nothing but a good trend in organisations generally. I think just popping back to Cannes as well, I think actually it was really encouraging the lack of purpose washing that we saw. And on the few, I mean, literally there were a handful of cases that were very obvious, you know, purpose washing, which obviously got discarded quite quickly. You know, we've seen some really great moves, like John Lewis earlier this week announcing that they're going to, you know, build housing that will be for rent. It sort of reminds me of going back to when Unilever set up Port Sunlight.
I also think, Arvind, if I can, I also think we mustn't lose sight of purpose with a small p. I mean, people live complex, difficult lives. Many people struggle with them. I mean, the organizations that bring joy, deliver you food when you want it, deliver you fashion goods when you live in the middle of nowhere. The things technology and others do to make life wonderful, the purpose with a small p is massively important. And we shouldn't forget that in our search for purpose with a capital P around ESG.
Purpose in general should be absolutely tied to the business, shouldn't it? I mean, it should be tied to the business strategy and what that business performs.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right, let's move along to the big announcement in the past week. The government is planning to remove all COVID restrictions on the 19th of July, despite rapid increases in COVID cases and hospitalisation. Some have called the move reckless. Tony, I think you're one of them on Twitter. Why do you think the government is doing this, and how do you assess their messaging?
Okay, I haven't called the move reckless because I think the country is ready for relaxation with the level of vaccination we've got. We need relaxation. We need people at sporting events. You know, as we've discussed, I'll be with 60,000 people at Wembley tonight. It doesn't that doesn't worry me at all. And no one's wearing a face mask in the stadium for people that haven't been. What I took issue with in the government's announcement was their stepping away from rules and moving responsibility to the individual, or more specifically actually to the local authority, in really, really difficult situations. So you had previously clear guidance on wearing a face mask. You now have ministers, prime ministers, medical advisors saying, well, it's obvious you should wear a mask in a crowded tube, and why don't you take your mask off if you're sitting in a carriage by yourself? But to give that choice to individuals is I think, I could use the word reckless for that. I think that's just unwise, and it's very difficult. And I think it puts some people in impossibly difficult situations. When a local authority running a tram decides that mask wearing is going to be compulsory in their tram, and some people get on the tram and say, well, the government says I don't have to, that puts a huge pressure on the driver or any employee of that network to do that. So what I didn't like was the just murkiness of that individual responsibility and relying on everyone to do the right thing for everybody else, when what's likely to happen is mask wearing is likely to become a sort of divide in society, where some people don't wear a mask to show that they believe in freedom, in inverted commas, and free speech. And some people do wear a mask to show that they believe in community. And neither of those are health things. So I fear mask wearing is going to be our big divide over the next 3-4 months. And it was unnecessary. And it's driven by government error on communication.
It's a really interesting point, because even within the government, Robert Jenrick, for example, on Mar on Sunday, said that he probably wouldn't wear a mask. And you're getting so many mixed messages from very senior people in government. So how on earth can anyone in the public, you know, find a common ground?
I mean, Johnson, you know, professed to be a lover of individual freedom. And ideologically, I'm also on board with that. However, we are in a situation that has shown time and time again where there is hard and fast guidance and there are hard and fast rules, it has, you know, helped us in this situation. So just to quote back the word that Tony used, because it's the right word, I don't think the murkiness of the response the government have given and the, you know, let everybody do their own thing is going to be particularly useful. Hopefully, because of the jab situation, we won't go back into another lockdown. But we are in a crisis, and I think some clear guidelines and rules kind of are called for, to be honest with you, in this particular instance.
And just if I can, just to add one thing, the government must be in the same position as most of us. I mean, I do surveys in my organisation. I see client surveys. I see Opinion and YouGov and other surveys. I mean, it's around 20-25% of the population are anxious about returning to the office, about returning to work, about returning to events. So you actually know that that's the number. So you've created a huge problem for those people with higher levels of anxiety, and it's quite a big number. You know, my company is about 20% from, I don't know who they are. My position is we all find our own pathways back to the office and our own pathways back to work, but the government knows that as well. And I think knowing that it's doubly bad. I think knowing that level, that high level of anxiety exists in some people.
Okay, let's move along to PR recruitment and salaries. We published a salary survey this week that found softer growth in salaries across the industry in the past year, which probably wouldn't surprise many people. But there are also some quite disturbing findings that women have felt the brunt of salary cuts. I want to go to Rachel and Tony about this. How have salaries gone in your agencies?
On a personal basis, we've been lucky. We grew throughout COVID, so it didn't affect us, and we've been able to, you know, reward our staff in the way that we would always want to. Obviously, I can't speak for other agencies. We may get onto this shortly, but I think the women point is very interesting because I think not only in our industry, I know it has been reported on, but without a doubt, women have not only taken the brunt of, I think, some of the salary pain that has been around, but I think also the redundancy pain as well. And as I said, that's not necessarily a PR industry issue, but I think as a general trend, that is it's incredibly worrying. And, you know, I've seen it with my own eyes with friends who, you know, have been very senior, not in our industry. Their boss has managed to keep their job, who's been a male, and they've been doing a four-day week and they've been the one that's been made redundant. I don't mind saying, I think there has been, albeit perhaps unconsciously, but discrimination in that regard in terms of job losses within the female sector. But, you know, I know we're talking about salaries, so I'm slightly getting off piece, so to speak.
Well, it's all related, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Tony, what have you observed at Lansons?
Well, it really complicated story, I think. So at Lansons, the same as Rachel's business. I mean, our fees grew by 4% the last financial year, and our costs were 20% lower. So it was, you know, financial terms, it was a great year despite how difficult it was for lots of people. So we've been re-rating salaries upwards, paying good bonuses. I mean, my attention in the market is, you know, New York, everyone's talking about this year as the great resignation. You know, people just, you know, and there was a Microsoft survey, I think 3 weeks ago, saying 40% of all professional workers in the world would like to change jobs this year if they can. I mean, we're living through a time of, I think, the great exhaustion, the great resignation, lots of turnover, changing of staff, changing of life situations. And I think that's the prime driver of the London market at the moment. I'm not seeing people particularly moving for increased salaries, actually. And that's the whole point of the Great Resignation, isn't it? It's a desire for change. So on that front, I that seems to me the driver. I'm lucky, although I'm a male chief executive. I mean, Lansons is more than 60% women. It's more than 60% owned by women. You know, obviously women at Lansons have been in the same situations as women elsewhere, but I feel we've done okay as a business. And you know, 75% of our work is in financial services. I haven't been able to spot what you might call discrimination, but then that's an industry that's behind the curve in terms of senior women. So that hasn't narrowed at all in this period. So it's a complex picture for me. And I'm not finding it easy to sort of say it's gone one way or the other way. But I think massive staff turnover is the key driver of London agencies for the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, I agree. And I think your point, I mean, to be honest with you, I think in some ways, because I agree with all the market dynamics that Tony's just talked about, obviously money is important and we've got to make sure that across the industry we are paying, you know, good talent, the right money. But I sort of think currently it's a secondary factor. People are reassessing what they want from their lives. And I think the bigger challenge is how do we address that and how do we ensure our industry is somewhere that people want to remain to be? Yeah.
Yeah, and not specifically women, but anyone who wants a non-standard working life, working week compared to what we all thought was normal 18 months ago, there's never been a better time to change jobs in mm-hmm. the professional world anyway.
I wrote a piece this week from talking to some agency bosses and also recruiters about the current situation with recruitment. Recruitment and retention is almost always at the top of the list of challenges among agency bosses and in-house comms directors whenever we ask. But I think there's a real difference this time. I mean, some of them were referred to earlier on about the sort of, you know, the period of resignation. But I think one of the problems in the PR industry is everyone went from practically zero recruitment over the sort of depths of the crisis to quite an active recruitment program virtually at the same time. So this means that there was no real pipeline. There weren't really conversations happening. Normally, you know, a lot of agencies will have sort of almost constant recruitment, or certainly a sort of a program that's bubbling under all the time and people always being tapped up. But this went from zero to 60 in a matter of minutes, matter of seconds. You know, you get the idea. Not surprisingly, it was kind of mid-level executive roles, kind of account director to associate director that seemed to be the most in demand. But we were finding that people were also being poached even younger. One agency boss described to me an uncomfortable situation with a junior account executive who had only been there a few months, who was kind of stuck in this to and fro between the person's current employer and their future potential employer. Whereas actually, it sounds like a good thing for them, but it isn't necessarily, because sometimes they'll say what they want to do is just get settled and have their first taste of agency life. So we're definitely seeing that. We're seeing sometimes uncomfortable conversations around office attendance. I mean, this is obviously a broader point about the opening up of offices and the sort of hybrid working models that everyone's been talking about. And I get the impression that quite a few employers are frustrated about some employees maybe using spurious excuses to not go in when they probably should. I know this is a delicate area, and obviously some people have very justified reasons for not going in, and each employee needs to do it on their own basis. But one agency boss told me that an employee didn't want to come in one day because it was raining, which I think is quite something, really. And we had some research this week from the Work Search recruitment agency that was slightly worrying for PR agencies. It said that basically 7 out of 10 corporate comms professionals on a survey that they had said that they expect their next role to be in-house, and only 11% said it would be an agency. In fact, more people said that they're likely to have their next role either outside the industry or going it alone or setting up their own agency than working at an agency. It should be a bit of a concern for agencies. And so it'd be good to get views of the two agency bosses on the call about recruitment at the moment and what you make of these trends.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, to be honest with you, John, everything you've just said about recruitment trends is true. I think particularly in terms of the pipeline piece, you know, we did recruit last year, but we definitely weren't sort of nourishing the pipeline in the same way that we would have done in normal circumstances. And now we need to recruit quite heavily. So it feels a bit like starting from stock. I think, you know, the challenge we've got as an industry is one we touched on earlier, which is ultimately, we have to be fantastic employers. We have to provide people with a, you know, a fulfilling and creative and challenging in a really positive way environment, so they feel that they're getting the best out of it. And I think we're really going to have to focus on that, because people are reevaluating their options and it is a buyer's market. But I think at the same time, if we do all take that challenge on, then hopefully it will, you know, help the agency landscape evolve in terms of what it looks like for potential recruits, and will only be better for it.
It's no use agency people moaning if their staff think in-house is better. It's about competing. It's about making what we offer attractive and lively and vibrant, but also as long-term, as secure and as well remunerated and as feel good. Yeah. And I think that's the challenge. I suspect we're going to go into some kind of unknown world. I mean, at Lancers, we've had a history of, we always take lots of people at account executive level, you know, probably in an average year, you know, between 5 and 15, depending on the type of year. And we have a long history of those people staying for 5, 10, 15, even 20, 25 years, their whole career. That model's probably gone. I suspect so. Companies that used to do that will now establish themselves with people. Those people may leave for a bit and we'll try and attract them back. So alumni networks become the focus, and people having 7 or 8 roles, or people wanting change throughout their lives. I personally think it's going to be just as exciting as every other period. It's just different. And I'm really excited by it. And, you know, if young people have got more choices, well, that's bloody good, isn't it? Good for them.
Well, I'm afraid that is all we have time for. Thank you, Rachel, Tony, and John, for joining us. And a big thank you to our producer, Lindsay Riley, from Rethink Audio, for putting this episode together. If you'd like to read more about all the issues in PR, please visit our website, prweek.com/UK. Thank you for listening today, and please join us next week. Until then, goodbye.